The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Good evening, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm your host, Eric Peabody. And tonight, dear friends, we're finishing up our coverage of J.G. Martin, at least for the time being. Tonight, we have two stories from him, one of which is in his Facility series, and another that's just a fun little treat at the end. With a little luck, we'll feature more of J.G.'s stories in the future. Tonight's episode is a bit shorter than the last two, so let's just jump in, shall we? You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author J.G. Martin, I give you Jagged Janice. I'm a government employee. My name isn't important. All you need to worry about is what I have to say. I work at a compound known as the Facility. Within it, we perform research on things the public would find unappetizing. Officially, we're listed under experimental weapons development, but lately, our umbrella has spread much wider. Suffice it to say that there are things out there that go bump in the night, things both legendary and mundane that exert their influence upon us and defy explanation. My job is to interview individuals who believe they've encountered such entities and determine if their accounts are fact or fiction. What my job is not to do, however, is to share those interviews. In this case, though, I don't think I have a choice. The room is cramped, dimly lit, and smells vaguely of stale piss and black mold. A light hangs above the table between us, rocking back and forth and doing a poor job illuminating much of anything. Still, I can see the man's gaunt face and the fields on my clipboard. It's enough. It'll do. I ask the man to tell me his story, and we begin.
"It happened at the cabin," he says.
He's 20-something, with a long nose and 5 o'clock shadow. When he reaches for his cigarette, his hand shakes like a 1950s pickup truck.
"Not my cabin," he adds. "It belonged to Emily, but she invited us up, the three of us."
My pen scratches across my clipboard. Four individuals. "For leisure, I'll assume." He cocks an eyebrow at me.
"Yeah, I guess."
A laugh escapes his lips. It's short, awkward.
"Why else do people go to cabins? We just wanted to get drunk, stoned, forget our problems for the weekend. You know, like normal people."
"Of course," I say, marking down his response. His eyes dart toward the cameras in the corner of the room, and his tongue slips across his lips.
their chapped, cracked, and bleeding. He looks worse than a mess. What he looks like is a disaster.
"The cameras," he says. "What's the deal with them? You said you weren't a cop."
"I'm not," I reassure him. "The cameras are for my own records. Events, encounters with the paranormal. Well, they're tricky things. Sometimes we catch items in recordings we'd otherwise miss in person." He stares at me a while. His lip curls in, his teeth gnawing at it. It's a look I've seen before, the sort of look where he's wondering if maybe he's being played. He's wondering if this is a sting operation, and he's taking the bait, and I'm going to have him thrown into a psych ward, or worse.
"It's better if you tell me everything," I say, placing my clipboard on the desk between us. "I'm not here to have you put away, only to get some answers."
A moment of dead air hangs between us, and it's the sort of moment I recognize. He's weighing the situation, sizing me up. He's wondering if he's comfortable talking about something this batshit insane to a total stranger. But then he takes a deep breath, followed by a deep drag, and ashes his cigarette.
"Sure,"
he says. He taps a finger on the desk, gathers his thoughts.
"It happened late at night. The four of us had been drinking in the cabin, doing mushrooms, but we all slept outside in tents since the place was full of spiders. Hardly ever got used."
"Why's that?" I check a box labeled intoxicated. He shrugs.
"Bad memories, I think."
I tilt my head to the side, inviting him to continue.
"The cabin belonged to Emily's mom," he explains. "She passed away when Em was a little girl, and the place has been a mausoleum ever since. Em thinks it has bad mojo."
"What do you think?"
"What do I think?"
He tastes the question.
"I think that..."
He trails off, his eyes losing focus, gazing at the splintered wooden table between us. Suddenly, he seems far away. There's an emptiness in his expression, a disconnect. I wonder if he's thinking of legends and nightmares. I wonder if he's thinking of Jagged Janice. "Is everything all right?" He blinks, then nods. My pen scratches across my clipboard. Subject appears traumatized, avoidant.
"What's that?" he asks. "What are you writing?"
He leans forward, narrowing his eyes on my form. I pull it away.
"It's private."
"How come?" "Your knowledge of my notes could influence your account. I'd prefer it if such biases were avoided." He looks angry as he sits back in his chair, pissed. He's gnawing at his lips again and his fingers tapping the table like a Gatling gun. There's no doubt in my mind that this guy has been through a lot, but I need to make sure he's telling the truth. And in order to do that, he can't know anything. Nothing at all.
"Fine," he says at length. "We'll do it your way."
"Yes, we always do."
"Like I said, we were drinking in the cabin, swapping old war stories from high school, talking about stupid pranks we'd pull or places we'd tag, teachers we hated. We reflected. Pretty soon, though, we got drunk enough that stuff went deeper. We stopped talking about all the silly surface bullshit, and we started talking about the stuff that really meant something to us, the things that set our souls on fire."
"That's a poetic turn of phrase. Are you a writer?" He shrugs. "Let me rephrase," I say. "Would you describe yourself as having an active imagination?" The man studies me, gears turning in his head. Again, he's wondering if I'm goading him into an admission of insanity. He's wondering if I'm calculating what amount of antipsychotics it would take to counterbalance his paranoia, and what size straitjacket would best fit his scarecrow frame. But I'm not doing any of that. The truth is, I don't care if he's insane or perfectly lucid. I don't give a damn about him at all. All I care about is whether or not he's seen Jagged Janice and that he isn't another liar.
"My imagination isn't anything special," he says at length. "Now can I tell my fucking story, or are you going to keep interrupting?"
I smile. "Tell your story." He takes a breath, spares a half second to glare at me.
"The four of us are drinking in Em's cabin, and she starts to get, like, low, like depressed. She's usually a pretty upbeat person, so I ask her what's up, and she says she's just feeling a bit haunted since coming back to the cabin.
I lift an eyebrow. Her brother... The man sighs, shakes his head as though determining how best to phrase his next words. Her brother died at the cabin, drowned to death 100 feet from the door. Emily watched it happen. She watched her brother drown. He nods. She was 3 years old. She didn't understand what was happening, not really. There wasn't anything she could do. I see. It's a sad story, but not really what I came here for. Worse still, nothing yet matches the Jagged Janus legend. Anything else? The man looks up at me, and disbelief swims in his eyes. Anything else? No, asshole, that's it. She watched her brother die, and it made her feel like shit. I'm not here for Emily's story. I'm here for yours. You'll excuse me if I forget to feign empathy for a woman I've never met. I check a box labeled confrontational and rest my pen on my clipboard. Now then, you said you were drinking, talking. What happened after that? His jaw is set, clenched. He looks like he wants to slug me in the face, and honestly, I wouldn't blame him. But instead, he takes a drag on his cigarette and leans back in his chair. Fuck it. We drink and talk until our eyes get droopy, and then we go to bed. It's like any other night, I guess. That's so? Yeah. Up until a point. There's an implication in his words, but I'll deal with that later. For now, I need more details. I need to understand the setting of the event as clearly as I can. The police report, I say, glancing down at my copy of the document, mentions the incident occurred outside of the cabin. Is that correct? That's right. Can you describe it for me? The layout? He scratches the back of his head, brows furrowed. There's a picture being painted in his mind, colored by memories. It's a T-shaped cabin, capital T. There's 2 bedrooms on either side of the T, and at the very top center is a bathroom. The bottom of the T is the living area and kitchen, then the front door. Simple enough? I make a quick sketch of it on my form. According to the report, the event occurred in the washroom. I'd like you to talk about that. His mouth twitches. He sucks in on his cigarette like it's the last drag he'll ever have. Slow. Long. He burns it down to the filter, eyes bloodshot, and then he drops it into the ashtray. Got any more of these? Sure. I reach into my jacket and pull out a pack, tossing it to him. The man catches it and flips it open, but his hands are shaking. They're shaking so hard that he can hardly light the smoke after he slips it into his mouth. Let me, I offer. No, he says. I've got it. The lighter strikes, and a flame dances to life. You're the real deal, huh? I'm sorry? He lights the smoke, breathes in, then exhales a storm cloud. The real deal. You actually believe me, don't you? Maybe, I say. Truthfully, I'm still making up my mind. You said the 4 of you quit drinking to go to sleep. Back in your tents, I presume. What happened after that? He ashes the cigarette. Nature calls. I gotta take a shit, so I get up and head to the cabin. When I unzip the tent, though, I can't see the dirt in front of me. It's dark outside. Pitch black. No moon? He shrugs. Not much of one. All I know is I've got to do my business, and I'm not about to use the outhouse. Smells worse than death. So I make my way to the cabin. Once I get inside, though, this weird feeling comes over me. Weird feeling. Like I'm being watched. Promising. The place feels empty, lonely. It's just me, the bugs, and the light from my phone. The light's making shadows out of everything. The dusty fridge, cluttered shelves, messy counters. There's 1,000 shapes all around me, shifting with every step I take, and this feeling of, I don't know, dread comes over me, like I'm not safe. The man pauses. Sweat beads down his forehead. Sorry, he says. I just haven't thought about it in this much detail since the night it happened. Don't worry, I tell him. Events are messy things, and more often than not, they leave scars. Okay. Take your time. He gives himself a minute, catches his breath. Like I said, I don't feel safe in there, but I'm drunk enough that it doesn't faze me. I still got a buzz going from earlier in the night, you know. I think to myself, I came to take a shit, and some spooky shadows aren't gonna stop me. He chuckles to himself, shakes his head. But a few seconds later, I'm in the bathroom and locking the door behind me. I figure, why take the chance? So, he says, wiping his lips, I'm about to unbuckle and do my business when I see movement. It's in the top corner of the bathroom, in one of those little toilet windows, like the type that's clouded on the bottom for privacy or whatever, but clear on the top to let in light. I've seen those. Is that where you witnessed the event? That's where I saw the smile. Jagged Janice. Describe it. Honestly, he sounds hesitant, worried. Wouldn't it be better to just talk about the event instead? The smile is part of the event, I remind him. It's important that we get as many details as possible, no matter how uncomfortable your memories may be. He looks down, and his eyes drift out of focus. The smile is just a row of teeth. But the teeth are too big and too sharp to belong to a human, and there are just so many of them. I check my notes, consulting descriptions of Jagged Janice listed in old email chains from the early 2000s. I'd like to hear more about those teeth. Why? The teeth are important. Describe them, please. The man's uncomfortable. He's shifting in his seat like quicksand. And when he talks, his voice cracks, but he gives me what I want. The teeth are jagged, he says. Serrated, almost. Their lengths all over the place. Some barely break her gums, others stretch down, cutting through her lips. His fingers move again. They're tapping on the table. Tap, tap, tap. When I see the smile, my heart starts pounding. I'm frozen there, standing in the dark bathroom with just the light from my phone. My mind's reeling, but I know that whoever that smile belongs to, I don't want them seeing me. So I hold my phone up against my chest, tight as I can. I smother the light. The light, I say. Did the woman showcase an adverse reaction to it? Janice, according to her legend, loathes light. No, he says, shaking his head. Or, I don't know, I can't remember small details. At that point, my body's mostly adrenaline. There's a storm of it coursing through me and screaming at me to run or scream or fight this bitch or just do something, anything. But I can't. I just stand there, staring at her inhuman teeth, at her horrible, twisted smile, with my phone clutched to my chest like a crucifix. Then the smile begins to fade away, lowering itself until it's just a blur behind the foggy part of the window. In its place are two eyes. The man takes a breath, trembling. They're wide, angled all wrong, and they're leaking this black fluid. They dart around the washroom like she's looking for something. I stay still, still as I can, like I'm fucking paralyzed. There's no light in the room, none except the bits of moon framing the monster in the window. So I let myself meld into the darkness. I don't move an inch, and I pray to God that she can't see me there. He shivers, reaches for a cigarette, and takes a drag. Then I hear tapping on the window. Tap, tap, tap. It's followed by this chattering sound, and it takes me a second, but I realize it's her teeth gnashing together, open and shut, over and over again. I don't want to look at her. I don't. But part of me can't stop myself, and I glance up and I see her eyes staring back at me. Two tiny black dots in a sea of white. My breathing stops, my pulse races. Dribbles of piss run down my leg. It's just the two of us now, watching one another. I lean forward, my interest piqued. Much of his description could have been pulled from the Jagged Janice legend itself. The small black pupils, the rows of inhuman teeth. I check off the features on my clipboard as he goes. What does she do? I ask, when you lock eyes with her. He swallows.
She speaks.
What does she say?
I see you.
I write the words down and circle them three times. They're not familiar to the legend. Describe her voice to me. Does she sound old, young?
Her voice is quiet, hard to hear. The words sound like they've been pulled out of a wood chipper. The pronunciation's all broken and unnatural, like it's been cut up by those teeth.
Curious, I mutter.
Her fingers reach up and she taps the glass again. Tap, tap, tap. I chance another look, and all I can see is her terrible, serrated smile in the window. It's making me feel nauseous. I've never been that scared, you know. I close my eyes, wanting the feeling to go away for just a second, but when I open them again, the smile's gone. It's just me, alone in the bathroom.
He puts his face in his hands and lets the armor fall away. His shoulders quake with silent sobs. I give him a minute, then another. Is that all? I ask. No response. Sir? He keeps sobbing. I've been doing this job long enough to know when an interview's over. A harrowing experience, I say, giving my form a final swipe with my pen. I stand up from my chair, reaching out to shake his hand with a disappointed sigh. On behalf of the facility, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to share this with me. The man's sobs taper off. He blinks up at me with red, puffy eyes, and when he speaks, his voice is barely there.
It's not over, he says. There's more.
My heart thrums as I pull back my handshake. A smile slips across my face as I sit back down in my chair, centering my clipboard in front of me. Something else occurred.
Yeah,
he says, wiping his nose on his sleeve.
The next few hours turned into a nightmare.
I click my pen, skin prickling with goosebumps.
You don't say.
Now it's my turn to take a breath, to center myself and calm my nerves. How very unfortunate. Please, continue then.
It takes me 10 minutes before I can muster the courage to crack the bathroom door. When I do it gently, quietly. You can hardly even hear the shitty hinges creak, that's how careful I am. I peek out of the crack, looking for the smiling woman, terrified that I'm going to see her standing in the living area waiting for me. But I don't. There's nobody else in the cabin. It's just me. So I step out, moving across the hardwood floor. It creaks and groans with every step I take, and each time that it does, my heart skips a beat, and I expect to see her jump out of the darkness. I'm seeing that smile everywhere now, in every shadow and every window. I want to shout and scream. I want to call out to my friends in the tent and beg them to pull me out of this horror. But they're past the cabin door, out there at the far end of the yard. They're a world away.
And your phone? I ask. You never thought to use that to call for help?
Yeah, sure, he says, rolling his eyes. I'm on a backwater island off the coast of rural BC. I've got great cell service out there.
He shakes his head.
I couldn't get a cell signal if I climbed to the top of the tallest tree. My phone was a glorified flashlight.
So what did you do?
I psych myself up. I've got my hand on the front door and I'm ready to fling that thing open and scream bloody murder, run to my friends and tell them we need to start the truck now because there's a fucking monster on the island and... And that's when I hear it.
His fingers thrum the metal desk. Tap, tap, tap.
In the window next to the front door, I see a long arm in a frayed sleeve with crooked fingers playing against the glass. They're drumming a rhythm, something awful. It's noise masquerading as song. Then I hear her again. I see you, she says in a gravelly voice. The tapping gets faster, heavier. I pull away from the window, from the door, and fall back into the shadows of the cabin.
She must be 12 feet tall because her head cranes down into the window frame, all the way from the top of it. Her eyes are gleaming in the moonlight, darting around and swiveling again in ways they shouldn't be able to. She's searching again for something. Me, maybe, I don't know. The man finishes his cigarette and slips a fresh one out of the pack. He lights it, trembling, and sucks in on the nicotine. His expression softens. "Then she's gone," he says. "Gone?" I ask, disappointed. "Again?" There's nothing in the Jagged Janus mythology that indicates her vanishing and reappearing at regular intervals. "Gone," he confirms. "I'm alone." Time passes, minutes, maybe hours, I don't know. I just sit there in the living room, my ears and eyes straining for any sound, any movement, anything at all. I'm shaking and breathing in short bursts, terrified if I breathe too heavily she'll hear me. I wonder to myself how long it's been, how long there's still to go until the sun rises and somebody wakes up and comes to check on me or use the washroom. I think about using my phone to check the time, but the idea of its light giving me away terrifies me, so I don't. I just sit there and wait. "How long do you wait? Until morning?" He laughs, takes another drag. "Fuck no," he says. "It takes a while, but eventually I get calmer. Or maybe too scared to keep sitting there doing nothing. Maybe I just need to reassure myself that this nightmare has an ending. I don't know." He gnaws at his fingernail. I'm fucking quivering as I pull my phone out of my pocket, shaking like a leaf. I turn it on and my home screen lights up my face like I'm about to tell a campfire story. "What time is it?" 3:34 a.m., 2 hours from sunrise. The man sighs, running a hand along his jaw. "It's too long for me. I can't do it, you know. Can't wait. I decide I need to do something now, before that woman comes back, because I have this horrible feeling that the next time she shows up, she's going to be inside the cabin. She's going to find me. So I tell myself to make a run for it. Wake up my friends. It's easy, I think. I'll open my mouth and fucking scream my lungs out, and that way, even if she gets in my way, then at least everybody on the island will wake up, and maybe I'll get out of there in one piece. So I do it. I open my mouth, and I scream. But nothing happens," he says quietly. His expression darkens. Tears slip from the corners of his eyes, and his lip trembles all over again. No sound comes out. Instead, a hand that's long and crooked wraps itself around my mouth. It pulls my head back, and I smell rot and decay and seaweed. And a voice whispers in my ear like a lawnmower, "I see you." "Janus." I lean forward, gazing at him expectantly. "How did you get away?" He wipes his eyes, choking back the last of his sobs. "No idea. I blacked out. When I woke up, I wasn't in the cabin anymore. I was in a hospital bed surrounded by my friends."
"Same ones from the cabin?"
"That's right."
I check a box on my form labeled Survivor. Then I chew on the back of my pen for a second before checking a second box. Post-traumatic stress affected.
"And what do these friends say? Anything useful?"
"They tell me it's all their fault," he says. "Em mumbles about how we should have never come out to the cabin in the first place. Steve and Haley are blaming themselves for letting me get exceptionally drunk."
He cracks a bittersweet smile.
"Everybody wants a share of the guilt."
My eyes drift down to the man's file. "You said the island was remote. I'll assume the hospital wasn't local to it."
"No," he says. "It was off the island, an hour or so inland. I must have been out for a day at least, though, because I don't remember ever traveling there."
"Interesting." A recurring aspect of the Janus mythology is a sense of mild amnesia and the presence of minor to severe bite wounds. "What did the hospital treat you for?" He clears his throat. a mild concussion, and water in my lungs.
Water in your lungs? I say, incredulous. You're certain? Water in your lungs?
That's right, he says. The doctors didn't understand it either. I never even got a chance to take a dip in the ocean, let alone drown in it.
Okay, let me get this straight. So your friends pop by, leave you some get-well cards, and you get discharged a couple days later. I lean back in my chair, folding my arms. Does that about sum things up? The man looks away, rubbing his arm.
Not exactly. Before they leave, I tell them about the smiling woman. I ask them if they've seen her lurking around the island, and Steve and Haley look at each other like I must have hit my head harder than anybody thought. The look in their eyes, it's like they're terrified I've given myself brain damage. Steve squeezes my arm and apologizes over and over for doing shots with me. Says he should have gone easy for the first night. Haley agrees.
And your other friend, I ask, Emily?
She's standing back, staring at me, and her eyes are filled with, I don't know, regret. But it's different from Steve and Haley. She doesn't look like she feels sorry for me. She looks like she blames herself for all of this. I ask her one more time if she's seen the woman because I get the sense that she has.
I slide my pen down my clipboard and circle a word that says witness before annotating it with a small question mark. How does she respond?
She leaves, he says with a sigh. I don't think she wants to talk about it, at least not in front of Haley and Steve. Pretty soon everybody leaves. It's just me again, in some tiny hospital on the outskirts of nowhere. The only company I've got is the apple tree outside my window and the shitty TV. I sleep pretty uneasily that night, tossing and turning. I wake up at one point to the sound of tapping, and I stare out my window, horrified, expecting to see that woman again. But it's just the apple tree. Its branches are brushing against the glass. I wonder to myself if this is just my life from now on. If every time I hear the faintest sound at night, I'm going to wake up in cold sweats thinking that woman's come back for me. Then the door creaks open. My body goes into full-blown panic. My breath hitches in my chest, my muscles tighten, and it's like that night all over again with the smiling woman where I can't move an inch for fear. But it's just Emily, he says, chuckling in disbelief. She pauses in the doorway and asks me if she can come in. I tell her, of course she can. And she does, not bothering to turn on the lights. When she gets to my bedside, I can see her face more clearly. She looks rough. Her eyes have these heavy bags, and her cheeks are all red and splotchy from crying. She's wiping snot on her sleeve and telling me sorry over and over.
Sorry for what? Inviting you out to the cabin? I say, doing my best not to roll my eyes. I've never seen a group of friends with such a guilty conscience.
No, the man says. She says she's sorry for not warning me about the woman. She says she thought the woman was gone, otherwise she'd never have come back to that place.
What? I snap forward, eyes latching onto his. She told you she knew about her.
He nods. She says the circumstances of her brother's death aren't what she always said they were. He didn't drown. Not accidentally, at least. He was murdered. A woman attacked them on the beach. A woman with a terrible smile and this tangle of black, messy hair that covered her face. She dragged Em's brother backward through the sand, muffling his screams with her hand and muttering, "To the sea with you." Then she held him under the surf. She kept him there until he stopped moving and let the tide take him away.
Disturbing, I say. And she never brought this up to her parents.
She did. Her father told her it was just her imagination. He said that her brother had fallen into the ocean and gotten swept away, and it was already hard enough to deal with without Emily adding to it. So Emily just buried the memory, moved on.
The man looks up at me, his expression despondent.
That's about when we hear it, he says. In the hospital room, a tapping, tap, tap, tap. It comes from the window to my right, the one with the old apple tree.
The woman?
I don't look. I tell Emily not to look either. I tell her to focus on me, to ignore the sound. I don't know what she saw as a little girl down by the ocean, but I know I don't want her to see what I saw in the cabin.
He shudders.
I don't want her to see that smile.
Does she listen?
He grips a fistful of hair, closes his eyes.
No,
he says quietly.
She looks, and when she does, she screams. She screams so loudly that the lights come on down the hall, and I hear the night nurse call out and start running.
Emily rushes toward the window. I catch sight of it from the corner of my eye because I still refuse to look at that pane of glass, but I hear Emily beating against it with her fists, clawing at it with her nails. Then the nurse bursts in and pulls Emily away, calls a patrol car to drive her home.
The man takes a breath. He puts his face in his hands and rubs his eyes.
I text her an hour later just to make sure that she's okay and...
Yes, I say, cutting him off. I glance at the folder on my desk labeled correspondence, then down at the watch on my wrist. It's 3 a.m, and I'm jet-lagged. The meat of the man's story appears to have run its course, and my eyelids feel like lead bricks. If the texts are everything that's left, then I can read them on my own. I rise from the desk and offer my hand to shake. He gives it a weak, reluctant squeeze, avoiding my eyes. And then he leaves the room without another word. I sigh, sitting back down in the steel chair. Another long day, another dead end. I adjust my glasses and pull out the text logs. There's only a handful of message receipts. The chance is slim, but the possibility that there's something in there about Jagged Janice entices me too much to set them aside for tomorrow. I begin to read. As I do, I make note of the timestamps. Words do a good job of painting a picture, but time and location lend context to everything. 1:34, Dorian.
Are you okay?
2:12, Emily.
Not really.
2:12, Dorian.
Did you see her?
2:45, Dorian.
I'm sorry, that was a stupid text.
2:45, Emily.
It's fine.
2:46, Dorian.
I'm guessing you don't feel like talking?
2:46, Emily.
Actually, it might be good for me.
2:47, Dorian.
Yeah? Okay, me too.
2:47, Dorian.
I never got a chance to tell you earlier, but I can't imagine how horrible it must have felt to see what happened to your brother and have your dad not believe you. That's fucked.
2:55, Emily.
It's fine. We were never close anyway.
2:55, Dorian.
Sorry to hear. Did you ever tell your mom? I mean, before she passed?
2:56, Emily.
No. Mom was already dying by then, and Dad would have killed me.
2:56, Dorian.
Fuck, I'm an asshole. How could I forget something like that? Sorry again.
2:57, Emily.
You're not an asshole. You're right that I would have told her about Jonas if I could have.
2:59, Emily.
By then, she was so hopped up on painkillers, though, that I hardly even recognized her.
3:00, Dorian.
The meds must have been pretty heavy. That's a lot to deal with for a 4-year-old kid.
3:01, Emily.
Yeah, her esophageal cancer was bad. She was in a lot of pain near the end and rarely in a good mood. Pretty sure Dad was having an affair at the time, too. Fucking prick.
3:01, Dorian.
I'm sorry. That's a shitty memory to bring up.
3:03, Emily.
Don't be. I think I repressed a lot of old memories of her, which probably isn't healthy.
3:05, Emily.
Honestly, if it wasn't for you, I'd probably think I was going crazy right now.
3:05, Dorian.
Why?
3:06, Emily. I saw her too.
306, Dorian. The smiling woman?
307, Dorian.
M?
334, Emily. My mother.
334, Emily.
I see my mother. I stare at the last word in stunned silence. Her mother? Could she actually have been the origin of the legend?
I rub a hand along my jaw, considering what I've heard of Emily's history. She had only been 4 years old at the time of her brother's death when she witnessed a crazed woman drag him into the sea, a woman who she couldn't identify because black hair obscured her face. Could that woman have been her own mother?
It doesn't seem terribly likely, but it doesn't seem impossible either. Children often reframe moments of terror in a bid to understand the incomprehensible. I reach for my briefcase, unclasping the latches on the front and pulling out the laptop. I take a breath and then open up the database software. Emily is easy enough to find. Her last name is plastered everywhere across her social media, so I plug that in. The search function isn't the fastest, but it does the trick. It takes 30 seconds for the tiny, rotating hourglass to stop spinning. And when it does, I see her.
Subject: Emily Caldwell. Father: Harold Caldwell. Mother: Janice Caldwell, deceased. I swallow, my hands shaking on the keyboard. Had I finally found Jagged Janice?
I pour myself a glass of water, finishing it in two giant swigs. It does little to calm my nerves. Still, it's one piece of the puzzle solved, but really, it just creates more questions. It doesn't explain several aspects of the man's story. The water in the lungs, the vanishing. Certain pieces of his encounter don't add up, at least not compared to the original legend. There's a knock on the door, three sharp raps with a knuckle. I get up to answer it, thinking maybe the man's forgotten his phone or wants to give me back my pack of smokes. When I open the door, though, there's nobody. I raise an eyebrow and head back to my laptop. I need to discover the source for these changes, these departures from the Jagged Janice mythology. This time, I bring up my web browser, navigating to one of my preferred resources on urban legends. The website's a bit corny, but it's proven accurate, and its community aspect has been invaluable in my research. After some scrolling, I bring up the Jagged Janice article. People can leave anecdotal encounters beneath the main text, and sometimes they do. Usually, they're all bullshit. One of them catches my eye, however. It mentions seeing the serrated smile, the tapping fingers, and that they found their infant child dead with water in its lungs. I shake my head. A coincidence, that's all. I keep scrolling, and more keywords jump out at me. There and then gone. Voice like a meat grinder. To the sea with you. I pause. Those were the words Emily said, words she remembered when she witnessed her brother being pulled into the ocean. To the sea with you. My mind spins, but a picture is forming. The guttural, difficult to understand voice. The drowned brother. The words. I see you. No. She was never saying those words, not really. She was saying, to the sea with you. The man misheard, or perhaps he couldn't properly understand because of Janice's damaged voice. In his panic, he likely defaulted to the simplest sounding phrase. My heart races. I reach for my phone to make a call, to tell my boss what I found. It wasn't long ago the facility had an incident with a man with a red notepad. One in which we learned the core principle of all legends, and one which cost many people their lives. That legends evolve. If the Jagged Janice legend has evolved, we need to allocate additional resources to locating it and neutralizing it. I continue to scroll, noticing many of the anecdotes have been posted in the last week, several in the last few days. If even half of them are true, it'd imply highly increased activity on Janice's part. I hear another knock at the door, three soft raps. I curse, kicking off from my desk and storming to the door, phone still pressed to my face, waiting for my boss to pick up. Once more, I swing it open, and once more, I look down a cold, empty hallway. I slam the door shut and stalk back to the table. My phone continues to ring, and my boss continues to ignore my call. It's really not like her, but I tell myself to relax. She's probably sleeping. According to my watch, it's late as hell, 3:34 in the morning to be precise. That makes me an asshole, maybe, but this discovery is too big, too dangerous to ignore. Janice is out there, and she's on the move. Three more knocks ring out, but these are softer than before, more gentle. Almost taps. You've been listening to Jagged Janice by J.G. Martin. Now, to finish up our episode, I present The Man in the Moon, also by J.G. Martin. Believe it or not, the second trip to the moon made more headlines than the first. There was so much more riding on it. After the nuclear exchange of 2029, most of the world had resigned itself to death. Looting was widespread, riots claimed the streets. New York, Beijing, and Moscow, once the population centers of millions, all became smoldering wastelands in the blink of an eye. The world as we knew it was over, and all that anybody wondered was how long they had left until their city joined the rubble. But then something strange happened. Maybe an angel touched down, or maybe the madmen at the top finally realized just how close they were to losing it all, their wealth, their power, their subjects. Whatever the case was, they called off Armageddon. Enough, they said. We've had enough. And that was it. 90 million dead in the span of an afternoon was all it took to put things into perspective. After that, the world lost its taste for nuclear weapons. We lost our taste for war. After seeing the reality of what was waiting for us on the other side of our violent delights, the petty squabbles of our neighbors, our rival states, suddenly didn't seem to matter much anymore. But that wasn't enough. No, it wasn't enough to simply proclaim our distaste for conflict, to dismantle our nuclear stockpiles and address our nations and come together in peace. No, what we needed was a grand gesture, something spectacular. We needed the stars. So it was that the Return to the Moon initiative began. It was a joint effort, a collective push by Russia, China, and the USA that was helped along by everybody from North Korea to Canada. This time, we weren't just going to land on the moon, say a few inspiring words, and be on our way. No, this time we were going to stick around, colonize it, create the very first settlement on a solar body that people could live on. It wouldn't belong to any one nation, it would be independent. A true symbol of our commitment to never again bow to the seductive temptations of tribalism and war. It proved to be the gesture we needed. People rallied behind it, and it was supported by landslide margins on both the left and right, across practically every nation on Earth. We saw it as real proof that we were willing to set aside the shadow of mutually assured destruction, and in its place, walk together toward the heavens. And it was a good idea. It's hard to fault the sentiment behind it, and even now I feel warm just thinking of the unity we felt in those days. But it was also the catalyst that set our extinction into motion. When we launched the rockets, we always knew it would be expensive, risky too. The trouble is, we measured the cost in dollars and the risks in headlines and isolated tragedies. We figured we'd have one or two failed launches here, maybe a crash landing there. Nothing catastrophic. Nothing world-ending. A week after the first astronauts landed, their instruments began picking up strange seismic readings. According to them, it was as though the moon was tilting on its axis.
Soon, quakes riddled the surface, wrecking havoc on research equipment and drastically slowing surveys for the forward operating base. Then, 2.5 weeks into the mission, Earth received its final communication from the moon.
Houston, this is Alpha 3. Do you read?
Alpha 3, this is Houston. We read you loud and clear.
Roger. Houston, we have a situation.
Go ahead, Alpha 3.
We've had some issues with the crew. We've had to restrain 2 members, and I'm beginning to think we may need to restrain more.
This is the first we're hearing about this. What's going on up there?
Some of the crew have become violent. They attacked Major Donahue during a spacewalk. They looked like they were trying to pull her out of her suit, but we got to her in time, and she's okay.
Good work, Alpha 3. We'll need the names of those members. You said you suspect more members may need restraints?
That's correct, Houston. Tensions have flared in the last 2 hours, and arguments are becoming heated. We've had to break up 4 fights already.
There's more fighting?
The crew were at each other's throats.
Alpha 3, are you in a secure location?
Affirmative. I'm in the rover. The hatch is sealed. I know how much we have riding on this, Houston, but at this point, I'd recommend a full crew recall.
Understood. We're currently discussing it with the Alliance.
I appreciate that, Houston. I'm hoping that... Jesus!
Alpha 3?
They're all out there on the surface.
Say again.
They're on the surface, Houston. They're attacking one another, bashing in their helmets with rocks and... Oh, God. They're coming this way.
Alpha 3, do not engage. Ensure your rover's sealed.
No. No, I can feel it too now. I can feel it too.
Feel what? Alpha 3, what's going on up there?
It's eating me. My brain. It feels like liquid fire, and it's making me so angry. Fucking hell, Houston, this is... I think there's something crawling around inside my head, and its feet are like barbed wire.
We're preparing an emergency extraction shuttle right now. Remain in place. Do you copy?
Can you feel that, Houston?
Feel what, Alpha 3? Your first was broken and unreadable. Say again.
It's watching me.
That was it, the final transmission. 3 days later, on the night of October 3rd, 2034, the world ended. Cities burned, governments fell, each dying in the ashes of a chaos nobody could comprehend. Blood filled the gutters in flash floods of violence. Families, once happy and loving, butchered each other in their homes as mothers feasted on their daughters and fathers picked apart their sons. It was the end of times, the end of everything. Then, a light emerged in the dark, a light that shepherded us away from total annihilation, that saved what we now call the dregs of humanity, the leftovers. It began on social media, taking shape as a video streamed by a young woman in the throes of insanity. The video was called "The Moon is Watching." In it, she frothed at the mouth. She slurred her words. She moaned in disoriented agony as she spoke a broken warning about what the moon had done to her. Looking back on it now, it didn't tell us anything especially profound, but it spread like wildfire, going viral in the span of an hour as nations across the earth shared it in silent horror. "It's hurting my insides," she said, her body jerking and writhing. "It's crawling inside my head, behind my eyes, across my brain. It's cutting me up. I'm not whole anymore." She shrieked, and her back lurched, twisting and snapping, her tongue lolling from her mouth like a panting dog. Her eyes looked around, hungry and eager.
In her hand, she still held her phone, but it had become an afterthought. She didn't look at it, didn't so much as acknowledge it as she broke off into a run, her ragged voice snarling as she collided with another person in a blur of pixels. There's no video of what happened next. Her phone was discarded in the ensuing melee. But from the audio, it's clear that the person she attacked was a young boy. It's unlikely he survived. That video was enough, though. More than enough. Its message, as harrowing and twisted as it may have been, taught us an important lesson that night. Do not look at the moon. Avoid it at all costs. Draw your blinds, lock your doors, and under no circumstances venture out in the dark. There are madmen in the streets, or moonwalkers, as they've come to be called. Catch them during the day and they're lethargic, almost brain dead. But at night, something overcomes them, something sinister. They need violence to live like we need food and water. Somehow it sustains them. But even they aren't the true nightmare. No, worse than them are the lucid, the ones like you and me, the ones who still think with their minds, who still eat and drink, and haven't looked at the moon since the end of the world. They're the ones who break into your homes, the ones who steal your food and rape and kill with the practiced efficiency only real humans can manage. They're the ones building new cults, new religions. I'm not sure what the astronauts found when they went back to the moon. I'm not sure what they woke up. All I know is that these days, if you decide the nightmare of reality is too much to take, there's an alternative to death. Folks take it sometimes. They walk out into the night, and they stare up at the sky. They look at the moon, and the moon looks back. That was The Man in the Moon by J.G. Martin. J.G. Martin writes about monsters and the things they get up to when we aren't looking. His work has been featured across a slew of podcasts, captivating millions of listeners around the globe. Martin currently resides in British Columbia with his cat and editor, Opie. His ultimate dream is to one day own a secret lair behind a bookshelf. And that, friends, concludes our episode tonight. I'd like to remind you that J.G. Martin's collection, Crooked Antlers, is available in physical, digital, and audio format over at Amazon. And if you've liked his story so far, I can guarantee that it's worth your time. Thank you all for joining me, and I hope to see you again next week for more Horror Hill. Until then, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media, and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. That's ericpeabodyvoice. And we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.